Welcome to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Rolling Stone Executive Editor Nathan Brackett. Today we're going to talk about classic albums that we trashed when they first came out in our review section. We're also going to talk about new music from Beck and in reader mail, publicity stunts that have gone terribly wrong.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And that was Wow, the new song from Beck. We're here for our What We're Listening To segment with Brittany Spanos.
Hey.
Hey, Brittany. You wanted to talk about the Beck song today, which I'm loving.
Yeah.
Beck, as we know, like, you know, he won Album of the Year, Grammy, which shocked a lot of people, including Kanye West, a couple of years ago for the Morning Phase.
Yeah.
Morning Phase record. So this is kind of a moment for him. This is like his first record since then.
Yeah, and a huge shift from Morning Phase being this very low-key, folky album, and then him kind of going back to the slack rap sort of dancey sound with Wow.
Right, and that's kind of his like traditional move, right?
Yeah.
You know, he'll be like, you know, Sea Change and then Midnight Vultures or One Foot in the Grave before Odelay.
Yeah.
So Beck fans know what's coming, but this song is kind of like the most, it's like totally unforced and like fun,
yeah.
You know?
It's fun to listen to. I mean, it's definitely him going back to sort of his weirder side.
I was probably in the minority a little bit with Morning Phase. Mm-hmm. Like, I really liked a couple songs from it, but I thought that the entire album kind of dipped in a bunch of places. Like,
for sure.
It wasn't up to the level of, like, Sea Change, which is, I feel like, his classic kind of acoustic record. So I'm totally happy for him and ready for him to kind of be fun back again.
Yeah.
And this song definitely has, like, some cool breakdowns, which I'm really enjoying.
It's like, right now.
Definitely the dips of the beat. It's definitely one of the strongest beats I've heard this year. And it's
for
just
sure.
Very like low key and dancey, but not too dancey. It's kind of a mellow dance song, which I really enjoy. Because my first encounter with Beck was Wero, and that album was just so much fun, and E-Pro and Girl and all that. So I enjoyed this sort of
reference
back to that.
I think that's definitely my like favorite Beck record from the last like 15 years or so. So yeah, he's got a new album coming in like September or October.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to hear what the rest of it is going to be. Your second song is a song we have talked about already on the episode, but this is a remix. Drake's One Dance, a remix by Justin Bieber.
I need a one dance, 1942 in my hand. One more time before I go. Body locking, put a hold on me. I need a one dance, 1942.
Justin Bieber teased it originally, I want to say like last week before the OVO Sound Radio, which happens every Saturday. And then
Drake's show on Apple Music.
Yeah. It had leaked a little bit in some various clubs, and then Drake finally officially released it. And it's really interesting because One Dance is Drake's first number one song, and I didn't actually realize this, but What Do You Mean was also Justin Bieber's first number one single.
Wow.
And it's weird to think about these two artists who have been so prominent for 5-ish years, a little bit over that, to have not reached
that's their... nuts. So like Hotline Bling wasn't a number one song?
It was number two.
Wow, that's
and
crazy.
And so it was just breaking. I remember he wrote this long message on Instagram about how he was like, everyone has almost made Hotline Bling my number one song and never hit it. But One Dance really broke through for him. And it's cool to see that this like more tropical world music sound that both of them are really hitting on. And these two artists who have been working together for so long, like Drake was in the Baby video, and they continue to sort of be there in each other's music in weird ways. So
and Bieber like fits seamlessly into this song. He's totally at home in the beat and kind of does some interesting things with his like phrasing. It's totally cool.
And he changes the lyrics a little bit to be like a little bit more romantic. It's a little more, you know, a little more longing than Drake's One Dance. So
absolutely,
that's an interesting. It's a very Bieber touch for the remix.
Right. This song is just in general just One Dance. The Drake version, the remix. The song is not going away. This could definitely be the song of the summer.
Definitely a front runner for a song of the summer.
Well, Brittany Spanos, thanks for coming on.
Of course.
Hey,
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Thank you.
In the days of my youth, I was told what it means to be a man.
And that was Good Times, Bad Times from Led Zeppelin. Probably the most famous band that Rolling Stone famously trashed in the late 60s when they first came out. I'm here with Andy Green and Brian Hyatt. And
what's up?
Hello. We're going to talk about classic albums and artists that Rolling Stone trashed when they first came out. This is going to be a fun episode. Andy, you probably know, on an issue-by-issue basis, you probably know Rolling Stone magazine better than anyone at Rolling Stone.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Flattered.
Anyone who didn't actually work on that issue, you know, right, in the 70s. And Brian Hyatt, you're a student of the magazine and rock criticism in general. I don't know. What are you a student of?
I work here.
You work here.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Led Zeppelin. That is the most, that's been mentioned, you know, that like gets jokes in like, you know, the almost famous.
Yeah.
This is almost a meme.
I think what needs to be noted, which is not often said, is that the magazine at this point, when the first Zeppelin album was out, it was just 2 years old. It was a very new magazine. So this college student, John Mendelsohn, he just mailed in a review of Zeppelin 1 that he published in his college newspaper.
So it was a reprint.
People
should be blaming that college newspaper for those nasty reviews.
He cut out of his own newspaper that he wrote, and then he got Rolling Stone a few weeks later and was shocked to just see it there. And it was the beginning of a war with Led Zeppelin because he just tore it to shreds.
Shall I quote a bit from...
We should read a little bit from the... Yeah.
Jimmy Page, around whom the Zeppelin revolves... Everything was a the, by the way, in the 60s. Yeah. It didn't matter. It was like...
It was like the Cream, the Pink Floyd.
It was a rule. Yeah. You know, the Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
Anyway, is admittedly an extraordinarily proficient blues guitarist. Explorer of his instrument's electronic capabilities. It's weird. No one says things like that anymore. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Unfortunately, he is also a very limited producer... Come on, man. Yeah. And a writer of weak, unimaginative songs. And the Zeppelin album suffers from his having both produced and written most of it. And I'll just read a little bit more. The album opens with a lot of guitar rhythm section exchanges. I guess that's guitar / rhythm section exchanges in the fashion of Beck's Shapes of Things on Good Times, Bad Times, which might have been ideal.
That's Jeff Beck, not later Beck. At home.
Yeah. Which might have been ideal for Yardbird's B-side, which back then was a sick burn back then. I mean, it's like, man, that sounds like a Yardbird B-side. Everyone would be like,
That was the critique back then. Everybody, a lot of people who were serious about music were serious Yardbirds fans because they were the bearer of the blues, right? And Led Zeppelin were these kind of hacks
who pumped it up
to this crazy level.
Jimmy Page was the Yardbirds veteran, obviously, who was now perverting it. But then, I'll just, Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You alternates between prissy Robert Plant's howled vocals, fronting an acoustic guitar and driving choruses of the band running down a four-chord progression while John Bonham smashes his cymbals on every beat. The song is very dull in places, very redundant, and certainly not worth the 6.5 minutes the Zeppelin gives it. Now, say what you will about John Mendelsohn, he clearly heard this album.
Yeah.
To his credit, Mendelsohn has been interviewed about this a bunch of times over the years, and he stands by this, right?
Yeah. I have talked to him about it. I talked to him maybe 8 years ago for our Zeppelin special issue, and he told me that he just went on to YouTube and watched a bunch of Zeppelin and stands by everything. Still hates them, still thinks that they're pretentious and they suck. And at the time that Zeppelin 1 was new, the Jeff Beck group were like the hot band of former Yardbirds guitarist, and he thought that they were better.
Right. And he was not the only one. Yeah.
Well, for example, like Tom Petty
had
that album Mojo that had a little bit of to my relatively young ears sounded like Zeppelin. He's like, oh, no, I hate Zeppelin, Jeff Beck group. So it's like that for a certain like generation of hippie, the Jeff Beck group, which did have the combination of the riff and the howling vocals by Rod Stewart, by the way, in case you don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was set the template. So this just seemed like a ripoff. But and then I will say, you know, listen, Zeppelin 1 you know, it's not as good as they got later. Yeah. You know, you can imagine right. someone hearing and being relatively underwhelmed, I guess. You know?
And, right. so, and at the time, yeah. it was really overhyped. There was a lot of hype about Zeppelin before it started, and some critics were just like, what is this shit?
And there was a generational issue. These yeah. guys were a little bit older, and mm-hmm. Zeppelin was at that time for the children.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's just hard to put your mind in the place of where things were right. back then, because now it's all, especially now, like the line between Zeppelin and Pearl Jam is pretty thin. It's all just like classic rock with capital yeah. letters, but right. there really were a lot of divisions and disagreements, and the canon was being formed moment by moment.
And it's interesting because Mendelssohn was pretty young at the time, but he definitely was kind of reflecting a lot of the conventional
right.
wisdom.
And
by,
what angered the band a lot is that we brought him back to review Zeppelin 2.
Right.
Right.
The next year, and he just trashed him again.
So let's take a step back in a way, like, get at reasons why, like, critics often, or some, get records that become anointed classics 20 years later.
I mean,
not wrong or disagree. I mean, like, I guess I have a stake in this because I was the record reviews editor for years, and Lord knows we got lots of records wrong. We got the first Arcade Fire record, Funeral, we gave only 3 stars. I mean, for me, that's a 5-star record. Yeah, I think one thing that was amazing about the Mendelssohn thing is that they brought him back to review the second Zeppelin record, because right. that's one thing that we definitely would not do these days. I mean, I feel like my criteria when I was record reviews editor, and I think that still is true, is that you at least want to bring in a reviewer who would hear a classic. If the Arcade Fire made one, or if Led Zeppelin made one, or if Demi Lovato made one. And you're not doing your job if you're not getting someone who's going to give it a fair shot.
And I think that was the institutional, I think everyone pretty much agreed about Zeppelin is what was going on. And I mean, the other thing to remember is, you know, to this day, these reviews of Zeppelin 1 and 2 live on in Jimmy Page and Robert Plant's minds. They were so aware of them, and it was so hurtful. And I think there's a case to be made that these super negative responses only drove them to try to make more and more ambitious music that no one could possibly dismiss. So in a way, I think they should thank John Mendelsohn for Stairway to Heaven.
And
or Spirit, depending on
it took Cameron Crowe until 1975 to make peace with them because they refused to be on the cover at first. This pissed them off for years.
Cameron Crowe, who was, of course, you know, famously very young and was of the generation that saw Led Zeppelin as gods.
Them. Yes. Yeah.
All right. Well, what's the next one on the docket?
Do you want to do Greetings from Asbury Park? Should we do Greetings?
Sure. Yeah, this was the first Bruce Springsteen record, 1973. He was being hyped a lot as the new Bob Dylan. And we had Lester Bangs do the review.
The great Lester Bangs. One of the greatest rock critics of all
time. The album was out in January. We didn't even review it until that July.
Right. Wow. See, well, this is pre-internet.
Right. Things were slower back then. Right. And
it's it's very interesting. So Lester Bangs is, you know, perhaps the most famous rock critic of all time. And you have Bruce Springsteen, who's the most famous Bruce Springsteen of all time. And so here on Bruce's very first album, and this is a chance, you know, could Lester see the entire future? Could he see that this would become? And like, absolutely not. He delivered this fascinating sort of idiosyncratic review that wasn't negative, but just saw him as a curiosity. And some of it is like basically incomprehensible to people now, because there's a lot of references to P.F. Sloan, who was a sort of seen as a new Dylan in the 60s. Eve of Destruction and stuff. So the boy howdy, the first thing the world needs is a P.F. Sloan for 1973. And you can start revving up your adrenaline, kids, because he's here in the person of Bruce Springsteen. not exactly the kind of blurb that Bruce was going to use in the...
At the time, rapping people, calling people a new Dylan in a kind of a bad way was not uncommon. I mean, like, there are lots of new Dylans, and so I think a lot of Bruce Springsteen did get that tag.
Because Columbia was promoting him as a new Dylan. That's what Lester was responding to. But it's just very funny, because when you read it now, and it's just sound, like, if you don't know who P.F. Sloan is, and you know he's Bruce Springsteen, it just sounds pretty crazy. But I will say, I mean, again, just like Mendelsohn, I mean, Lester really did listen hard to Bruce, because listen to this part. He's been influenced a lot by the band. His arrangements tend to take on a Van Morrison tinge every now and then. And he sort of catar mumbles his ditties in a disgruntled mush mouth, sort of like Robbie Robertson on Quaaludes with Dylan barfing down the back of his neck. I mean, like, listen, Lester was good. And then this is the part that just stuck in my head, and I'll stop reading. Because what makes Bruce totally unique and cosmically surfeiting is his words. Hot damn, what a passo o verbiage. And that those words, yeah. Hot damn, what a passo o verbiage, have stuck with me. I could recite those. And listen, he also, on the one hand, like, wow, he didn't understand. He didn't magically see that this would become, quote unquote, Bruce Springsteen. On the other hand, he really did address what was there before him, which was this dude like just spewing out words and throwing them onto Van Morrison arrangements.
And even Bruce would say the album is a compromise, whereas he wanted a band, the label wanted it to be more acoustic.
Right.
He was using a rhyming dictionary at the time. So in Blinded by the Light, it's just this endless verbiage, as he points out, but it was a weird way to write a song. And I think Bruce acknowledges that he got much better after this record, as much as I love this record.
Well, I'm happy that Lester kind of trashed it in an entertaining way rather than like gave it like kind of a mealy mouth 3 stars or something. You know, if you're gonna go down in flames or take a contrary view, you might as well have fun doing it.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even say he trashed it. I think he was just sort of reckoning with it. Like, I think it's like
a playful dismissal.
If you translate it from Lester ish to English, it's sort of like, it's like, wow, there's something here, not sure what, like,
right.
Not the new Dylan. And then at the end, interestingly, I sort of just noticed this passage, he points out that he's really good looking at the end. One look at the pic on the back will tell you he's got the glam to go places in this Gollywood lawn world to boot, whatever that means, but I guess he's good looking. But then maybe we'll do this review of the Queen album, Jazz, and we're talking about it not so much because of this specific album, but because, man, Queen, I'll say when I first got to Rolling Stone, like in my first 2 weeks, I happened to talk to Brian May on the phone, and he said, how long have you been there? And I was like 2 weeks? And he's like, oh, good. Oh, thank God. Okay, we can talk.
Thank God, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Because, you know, basically it's like there was this talk about a band that really felt that we didn't appreciate them. So, I mean,
I think they didn't feel it. They knew it. Appreciate them in the 70s, for sure.
I think they were lumped into other prog bands when Queen are not really prog at all, but these big bombastic bands are playing arenas with smoke machines and everything. We sort of trashed most of them. It just wasn't seen as the critical choice at the time, that kind of music. It wasn't James Taylor. It was for kids, and it was ridiculous, and it just seemed just like Kiss or something.
And I think there was
who I liked.
Yeah, and I mean, listen, and actually, I think this is a powerful put down of a classic band. If you
this is a review from Dave Marsh, not of a classic album, Queen Jazz, but like, yeah, you talked about a couple of graphs where he really goes at them.
And there's no jazz on Queen's new record, in case fans of either were worried about the defilement of an icon. Queen hasn't the imagination to play jazz. Queen hasn't the imagination, for that matter, to play rock and roll.
Oh.
Jazz is just more of the same dull pastiche that's dominated all this British supergroup's work. The tight guitar-based drums, heavy metal cliches, light classical pianistics. That's a good word, pianistics.
Yeah. Right.
Four-part harmonies that make the four freshmen sound funky.
That is unfair. They have good harmonies.
And Freddie Mercury's throat-scratching lead vocals.
Oh.
And then I'll just jump down. He talks about fat-bottom girls objectifying women, which is, of course, very funny.
And that's a shitty song.
Giving Freddie... Well, anyway, but it's just funny since that really wasn't Freddie Mercury's particular interest in life. You know what I mean? That wasn't like... So then... The last paragraph is actually quite famous. Whatever its claims, Queen isn't here just to entertain. This group has come to make it clear exactly who is superior and who is inferior. Its anthem, "We Will Rock You," is a marching order. You will not rock us. We will rock you. Indeed, Queen may be the first truly fascist rock band.
Wow.
Yeah.
The whole thing makes me wonder why anyone would indulge these creeps in their polluting ideas. Listen, that is an wow. But I mean, imagine no one really writes stuff like that anymore. I mean, it'd be really interesting to read a takedown of a pop artist like that, actually.
And I mean, some of this stayed with some of the band. I mean, after they didn't play South Africa.
They played Sun City and got all the shit for it.
I'm sure some of this stuff, these thoughts are in the back of people's heads. Yeah.
It's definitely interesting. And it's just... It just kind of seems not like right. In retrospect, like it just I think maybe just knowing the fact that Freddie Mercury was a closeted gay man who was singing from that perspective, and was singing for on behalf of people who are marginalized, and just knowing that stuff kind of like, it really does kind of shift the whole idea of what you're seeing.
Right.
You know, I imagine maybe if you did see him in whole, saw a whole stadium going, "We will rock you," and you're thinking, and if you came from a certain perspective, yeah, maybe it is a little bit disturbing, you know?
Right.
Yeah, it's a fun rock song. He's ridiculous. It's,
you know, listen, I think that's fantastic writing.
Yes.
And very like clear thinking in its goal of taking down a band, and I think the world could use more of that right now.
Sure.
But it is interesting. That's how we saw Queen of all
yeah,
people.
Sure. We move on. I think we should do High Voltage by AC/DC.
Okay.
Another band, AC/DC, another band infamously trashed by lots of rock critics, Rolling Stone and elsewhere.
And this is by the great Billy Altman, who I knew and was a great guy, but not a fan of AC/DC. "Those concerned with the future of hard rock may take solace in knowing that with the release of the first U.S. album by these Australian gross-out champions, the genre has unquestionably hit its all-time low." This reads, by the way, like one of the fake reviews in Spinal Tap of Spinal Tap.
Yeah. Right.
Things can only get better. At least I hope so. "A band whose live act features a lead guitarist, Angus Young, leering menacingly while dressed in schoolboy beanie and knickers, AC/DC has nothing to say musically. Two guitars, bass, and drums, all goose-stepping together," here we are with the fascist again,
right,
"in mindless three-chord formations. Lyrically, their universe begins and ends with the words I, me, and mind. Lead singer Bon Scott spits out his vocals with a truly annoying aggression, which I suppose is the only way to do it when all you seem to care about is being a star so that you can get laid every night. And that, friends, comprises the sum total of themes discussed on this record. Stupidity bothers me. Calculated stupidity offends me." I mean, it's like he's not wrong.
Sure he right. is. Sure he's no, wrong.
I mean, they are like, calculated stupidity.
He's articulating a point of view, and it's like, again, I think there is the generational thing in the sense that, like, rolling the first generation of rock critics, and Billy Altman is great, too. He wrote a lot of great reviews.
Of course.
And the goal of this overall is not to trash any particular writer. We're just talking about kind of what happens with reviews sometimes. But, a lot of Rolling Stone came out of the generation where, artists were supposed to say something, or
break some... dirty big balls.
Right.
Yeah, that's not...
and a lot of writers, who were fans of 60s, rock, saw the 70s as the first time where, like, bands were just stars for the sake of being stars, or so they thought. Right? Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, and I think AC/DC, some of the stuff on their early albums is pretty indefensible, actually.
It's juvenile, but it's fun.
If you really delve into it, some of it is... I was surprised, frankly, when they played Coachella that some of the younger cohort didn't dig into their lyrics and get a little freaked out. But it's all
fucking
cheek. Well, I think they know what, a lot of, AC/DC fans know that now, if you're reviewing them according to the lyrics, you're listening to the wrong thing. Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
But he's right, though, in the sense that there is an element of calculated stupidity to what they do. But the thing is, now we might say, but it's gloriously calculated stupidity.
Yes, exactly.
Stupidity, right?
That's exactly what it is. That's why it's 45 years later, they're still playing stadiums.
That's always the good trick is now you just say gloriously moronic, and then it's good, just add gloriously fascist.
Yeah,
That's right.
How about we move a little? Let's fast forward a little bit in the 90s, maybe get a little bit of alt rock.
Should we do Nirvana
here
now?
Yeah, sure. Let's talk about Nirvana. This is a famous one. Nirvana's Nevermind. We gave it 3 stars in the magazine. I think it's been corrected on the website. I think it's got strangely 4 stars on the website. I'm not exactly sure.
It says 4 stars
because it's obviously a 5-star classic.
Foggy on the details. I heard this writer was given a cassette tape of the record and had a very short time period to digest it and review
right.
it. And that's what often happens, that you have some brand new album that you never heard, you have a very tight deadline, and you need to make an assessment that will last forever.
Right. There's always the thing where it's like, how many records have all of us heard where we haven't realize that they were classics until the 10th listen or the 20th listen.
Exactly,
or,
which is the problem with all record reviews.
Right.
Is
or 6 months later. Yeah.
But again, I'm drawn to the part of the review where he seems to get it pretty right. So he says, given the small corner of public taste that non-metal guitar rock now commands. So note that. How could he know that Nirvana would basically single-handedly expand the space that would command? I mean, that's why you can't see a paradigm shift coming. So he's saying, given that, the Washington State Trio's version of the truth is probably as credible as anyone. See, he knew it was good. And a dynamic mix of sizzling power chords, manic energy, and sonic restraint, Nirvana erects sturdy melodic structures, sing-along hard rock as defined by groups like the Replacement, Pixies, and Sonic Youth, but then attacks them with frenzied screaming and guitar havoc. Now, that's a precisely correct description of Nirvana, right? Like, he completely nailed what Nirvana was. It's weird, I'm reading the parts that could be the four-star rave. Nirvana's undistinguished 1989 debut, Bleach, relied on warmed-over 70s metal riffs. And listen, do you guys disagree with that? I mean, I don't think Bleach is that great. But the thrashing Nevermind boasts an adrenalized pop heart and incomparably superior material, captured with roaring clarity by co-producer Butch Vig. See, these are like...
This is also the thing, and is another caveat. We should know that often the writers of these reviews did not give the star rating. The editors are in charge of the star rating.
Yeah.
And so who knows what this review was originally filed at. And, you know, maybe the record reviews editor at the time listened to it and decided they didn't love it.
Yeah, and it's also like, there's a thing, it's like, it's very hard to make the leap when you're, you know, back then you were getting like a big pile of CDs, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe advanced cassettes, probably promo cassettes. And you're listening to them and like one is like, wow, this sounds really good. This sounds good. I love it. You know, but a lot of music sounds pretty good, you know? And it's like, there was that Teenage Fan Club album the year before. That sounded pretty good too. Yeah. That didn't change the world, you know? And so it's like, so it's how many people are going to take the leap and be like, this is going to change everything.
Right.
This is an instant classic. I love it. I know you've barely heard of this band. Their last album kind of was just nothing. But there's just very few. There are cases, and God bless critics and sometimes people. There's the other thing where people go nuts and say something's classic when it turns out to be nothing. There's a lot of that too.
Right. And every once in a while we get it right.
And once in a while we get it
right. But you're right, it's a conversation, yeah.
But what I like looking at all these reviews is look how hard all of these critics listen to these records because they got fundamental truths right, whether you disagree with the conclusions they got. But you know, I think that's really admirable. Like,
right.
Like, I mean, look at this. You know, he had like, you know, 3 days or whatever to listen to Nevermind, and he nailed all of the correct influences and the core of their sound. And I think that's awesome, you know?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
And this poor guy has been eviscerated for the past 25 years with this one review. It's in every Nirvana book. It says, and the Rolling Stone gave it 3 stars. And it's in...
Wow, Rob is a super famous rock critic. And the truth is, fundamentally, he didn't get anything wrong at all.
No.
If you ask me, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Other than the failure to predict the future, you know?
All right, let's move on to another 90s alt-rock record, Weezer's Pinkerton.
Yeah, I think in the history of the magazine, this is one of the reviews I hear most about on Twitter and Facebook and comments because Pinkerton has become one of the most worshipped albums of the 90s. It's revered in every possible way, and we put it on our critics list as one of the 3 worst albums of all of the entire year.
Right. The actual review is like kind of a gentleman's 3 stars, right? And it's kind of benign, but like, you know, mixed, you know. But then you're right. We call it one of the worst albums of the year.
Yeah, which is very unfair. But I think that the first album was so... There were so many big singles on it. There was Buddy Holly, Satan. So there were songs that the first time you heard them, they were so catchy. And this was more introspective. It was darker. And it bombed. I mean, at the time, the fans agreed that it was no good. They didn't buy it.
It was a commercial flop. Yeah. It wasn't what people were expecting.
Now, but they didn't like it back then.
How dare you make the same mistake that we made is basically what the fans are saying.
Basically.
It wasn't until kind of in the 2000s and emo.
It started in like the very late 90s. It was like 3 long years out at the time when it became this cult classic.
Right.
And then Rivers disowned it. And he called the fans that enjoy it little bitches. And the more he pushed back against it, the more that they clung to it tighter and tighter. It was this weird thing for a while. It was like Smile or something, you know. This was like forbidden music. They wouldn't play it in concert.
Andy encouraged me to read to Rivers Cuomo on the phone.
Yeah.
Because I can't even remember, but so was it that he had previously said bad things and now he was saying good things? Okay, so he tended to say, oh, I never trashed Pinkerton. Yeah. So Andy had me read to Rivers on the phone like the exact horrible thing he said about Pinkerton, which was uncomfortable. He's like, oh, you know, I say things, you know. We say things. But so I wanted to read one part of the review.
That'll make our reviewers feel better, right? Rivers Cuomo got it wrong, too.
That's right. Well, that's a whole other interesting thing. But I was struck by one part of the review review. As a songwriter, the band's singer and guitarist, Rivers Cuomo, takes a juvenile tack on personal relationships. Throughout Pinkerton, he pines for all the girls he can't have, the girls he can have but shouldn't, the girls who are no good for him, and the girls about whom he just isn't sure. Yeah. And so basically, what I like is that the writer, Rob O'Connor, sort of jumped ahead past the fan embrace to the current moment where actually a lot of people are taking a feminist perspective and questioning the way Rivers depicts his relationship with women in his songs. And he kind of got it then. And it's like, yeah, this is kind of juvenile. Like, these women are just objects for you, for your own kind of psychodrama, and that's not cool.
And
so, Rob O'Connor was woke back in 98, God bless him.
It's a bit creepy at times.
On
a bunch of the songs, the context was he was at Harvard at the time, and he was like 25 or something and is just having these weird crushes on all these girls that want nothing to do with him. And the album is about that. He actually invited a girl to a Green Day concert. She said, sorry, I have not heard of that group, and just walked away from him.
The album should be called, like, Why Didn't I Just Tell People I Was in Weezer? I never got that, but it's like, I mean,
he had a beard and a limp, and he was the weird old guy.
I sang Buddy Holly, and that would have helped, but anyway, okay.
Well, I mean,
off track here.
But I mean, I think the this is certainly not an excuse for our reviewers over the years, but I mean, I think the idea is.
It is.
We're trying. This is part mea culpa, for the magazine, but partly, the fact is, the idea, very few, classic albums, with some exceptions, but many classic albums don't become classics until years later, no matter as much as we'd like to say that, we get everything right the first time out. A review really is kind of just the first draft of history. And often, Pinkerton, is a good example because it didn't become a classic until you kind of a whole genre kind of enveloped around it, with the exception of maybe some things Sgt. Pepper,
Overpraised.
Maybe overpraised at first. Yeah,
it's the worst album.
But Pet Sounds, on the other hand, wasn't.
So the moral of the story is no one knows anything. And just, give us a break.
Hopefully the best you're doing is you're saying something smart at the time. Or something, you're bringing some insightful and you're bringing your point of view. Yeah. And you're listening hard. Yeah. You're right.
And these bands were really hurt because pre-internet and everything, the review of Rolling Stone was a really, really big deal.
Right.
There were fewer forums back then for people to express their opinions publicly about music. There's almost none.
You weren't able to get on Twitter the day after the review came out.
You would buy Rolling Stone, and if they called you a fascist, it was just like, what the hell?
You just had to take it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And you couldn't tweet back or anything like they do now sometimes.
You just had to wipe your tears away with, your million-dollar bank account. But
Right. Yeah. Well, Andy Green, Brian Hyatt, thanks for coming on. This has been fun.
Thank you.
Of course. I'll get drunk all night. Oh, I'll get drunk all day.
And that was Buck Cherry's Too Drunk. Maybe the first time Buck Cherry's ever been played on the podcast. We're here for our reader mail section. I'm here with Hank Steamer, senior editor, RollingStone.com.
How's it going?
Thanks for coming on.
Pretty good.
Hank, you were the editor of this piece by writer Jason Heller on 10 music publicity stunts gone wrong.
Yep.
Which I quite enjoyed. My favorite one of all of these stunts is probably by Buck Cherry. And it was related to the song we just played. Do you want to tell us what the story was with this?
Yeah, there was an instance in 2008 when, there's all these controversies over music getting leaked. And at this time, Buck Cherry claimed that they were a victim of, music leakage. And there was a quote where they said, honestly, we hate it when this shit happens because we want our fans to have any new songs first. So there was this kind of self-righteous statement. And then it became apparent later that the group's manager had leaked the song. And it was somebody tracked them down through an IP address or something like that. It was proven that this was coming from inside.
Yeah, if you're going to blame the kids on leaking something, you better watch out. Right. They might look you up.
Exactly. So it was just...
That's hilarious.
It was, sort of like a Spinal Tap moment or... completely absurd.
Right.
Yeah.
There's one interesting letter about Elvis joining the army is kind of mentioned as a publicity stunt. And this reader, Cecilia73, says, reasonably, Elvis did not join the army. He was drafted. So it can hardly be considered a PR stunt. Can you imagine how the greatest star in the world felt about a 2-year hiatus from his career, not knowing whether he would have one to go back to, but he had no choice. And the fact that he carried out his duties in an exemplary manner says a lot for his character and made some of his greatest music after he came back from the army. So you did a little research into this, Hank.
I did, yeah. It's pretty complicated. I mean, Cecilia 73 is correct in this assertion that he was drafted, but there were some sort of loopholes that Elvis could have taken advantage of. Like there were these sort of different like categories he could have been placed under that would allow him to either basically just be a performer and do that as part of his service, or apparently the Navy offered to create a special Elvis Presley company that would just be like him and his friends and he could just sort of like take it easy. But like his manager did want to sort of like rehabilitate his image, like through sending him off, you know, to the army and saying like, you know, if you do this, you're going to look better, because everyone was kind of like, you know, there's this uproar of him being kind of lewd or.
Colonel Tom Parker actually encouraged him. He thought it would be a good career move to go into the army. Yeah.
Yeah. And so in a way, you know, it's kind of both. Like
right.
He was drafted, but it was also like his manager probably could have gotten him out of it, but decided not
right.
to.
So maybe like short of a stunt, like he deserves some credit, but the fact that there was some thinking, publicity-minded
yes. yes,
thinking
there was,
involved.
Yeah, there was right. some strategy.
This is all right. So we have another piece of reader mail from somebody named Magnus Hagermeer. They should have sent Pat Boone to the army instead. Elvis between 23 and 25 might have been his best years that was stolen from us. Nuts. Okay. We have another letter from someone, a Madonna fan named Saint Rye. Madonna's sex is a hard to find collector's item. Not so bad after 34 years. All right, fair enough. You know, I mean, like, not everybody would have agreed, you know, that it was a pure publicity stunt, but that's different strokes.
Maybe it's time to revisit Madonna's sex book. You know?
Maybe. Maybe. There was something missing that I was a little surprised about. We didn't include the infamous Rihanna jet plane trip. I don't know if you remember that, but that...
Slightly.
That involved Rihanna took a bunch, like maybe hundreds of journalists on kind of a world tour, like and went to 7 cities in different continents. I think Berlin, London, with a couple hundred journalists on a 747 or other jumbo jet in the back. And a lot of the journalists kind of like had a mutiny, you know, and they realized after they get on this plane, which seemed like a great idea, that they were actually just going to be flying and sitting on the tarmac for most of this trip
right.
and not going to be able to see Rihanna. And so it kind of had a different effect. You know, I'm sure everybody has a publicity stunt that they wish could have made it on this list. But.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, and this whole thing was actually sort of like, The topic came up because, and this was really just ended up being like a news blip for one day, but this band Yacht, who had created this, like, they basically said that they were the victim of, like, you know, a stolen sex tape, and then it turned
right.
out that they had like, you know, fabricated this entire thing, and then they got a lot of, it was just like, it was immediate backlash.
That was certainly this year's kind of biggest publicity stunt gone wrong.
Yeah.
For sure, that they got a lot of flack for that because a lot of writers thought it was like insensitive to people who'd been the victims of like revenge porn. And
exactly.
And all right, well, you know, maybe this like segment can serve as a cautionary tale for some artists.
Yeah, don't fake a sex tape.
On a plane with a bunch of journalists or anything.
Don't do any of this stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Hank Stieber, thanks for coming on.
Thanks a lot.
And that's it for Rolling Stone Music Now. If you like what you heard, leave a review on the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.